On arrival in Hamburg, they opened at the Indra nightclub.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Well, we'd like to sing Twist and Shout.
There were soon problems with the neighbours over the volume of their music, which led to their removal from the Indra to the Kaiserkeller. Bruno Koschmider again.
The next time the police came, they played very low and played waltz for one hour, so all the young people left. Well, this scene in the other club, Indra, with the Beatles, went on for a while, and then Mr. Koschmider had to close it down, and he says he thinks he lost about 100,000 marks on the Beatles because they were so loud, but he had a contract with them, and at that time nobody knew anything about the music, so nobody put anything about the volume into the contracts, so he couldn't do anything. After Tony Sheridan's time was over in the Kaiserkeller, Rory Storm and his group came, and because he still had the Beatles under contract, he put them on as the second group. So they played hour after hour, you know.
The drummer with Rory Storm was none other than Ringo Starr. It was here that they first worked together.
Rory Storm was more popular than the Beatles, so his impression was that they tried to impress the audience more, you know. And he says they behaved very bad. They called the audience Nazi Schweine and things like that. You know, they tried everything to be different. And he thinks most people didn't understand that at that time, what the Beatles were saying to them. But his club manager used to write all the insults down in a big book and told him the next day what they had been doing.
Well, this behavior didn't endear them to Herr Koschmider, but they were building up a strong following amongst the student population.
We'll be right back.
Particular fans at this time were Klaus Voormann and Astrid Kirchherr, a keen photographer who was later to become a closer acquaintance of the boys. They, too, were realizing their popularity, and so they approached Peter Eckhorn, the manager of a larger club, the Top Ten, for possible work before a bigger audience and with the chance of more money. Before they actually started, though, more problems arose. George was found by the police to be under 18 and was sent home. And when the other four tried to start on their own, there was more trouble with the police over a fire that had started in their former lodgings. Eventually, by Christmas 1960, most of them had arrived back at Liverpool, broke. Ted Nibbs, one of the early group managers.
The Beatles really came on the scene when a chap named Brian Kelly, who promoted jive shows, and he wanted a group for a Boxing Day show. Bob Waller rang him up and said, "Hey, Brian, I've got a group for you for tomorrow." He said, "Who are they?" He said, "Well, they call themselves the Silver Beatles." And he said, "Oh," he said, "are they good?" He said, "Yes," he said, "they're fantastic." Brian said, "Oh, how much do they want?" Bob said, "They want £8. And Brian Kelly said, "Not Pygmalion likely. I'm not paying any group £8. And then I'd have a lot of arguing. He said, "Well, I'll take your word, and as soon as it's tomorrow night, I'll give them six."
Bob Wooler, the compere of the concert.
There it was. There was the scene. There was this expectant crowd. It was a sort of Christmas crowd. They'd all been clamoured to the stage because something very special was going to happen for them. And the curtains were closed. We primed each other as to exactly what we were going to do. And I announced, here they were, direct from Hamburg, the sensational Beatles. As the curtain swept open, Paul launched himself into Long Tall Sally.
Soon after this date, Bob Wooler met up with Ray McFall, the owner of a jazz cellar, The Cavern, and as a result of that meeting, Bob moved in as compere of the lunchtime beat sessions. Bob, of course, was quick to promote his friends.
A month went by, and eventually they were accepted as an appearance. Well, I was to be castigated by Ray, because Ray had a very strong feeling about admitting people in jeans, because jeans had been identified with the Teddy Boys in trouble. And he didn't really approve of people going into the club with jeans on. And here were the Beatles playing on stage to his audience in jeans. And he developed a bit of a moody over that. But anyway, he was able to adjust. He was a very flexibly minded person. And he was to accept their slight differences to the convention.
From these lunchtime sessions, their popularity grew. Their name had changed to simply The Beatles by now, and they started doing evening sessions too. In April 1961 came more news from the Top Ten Club in Germany.
My name is Peter Eckhorn. They wrote a letter to me asking if they could play in the Top Ten in the future. And it was arranged that they play here April 61. And they played for 3 months.
Their contract with Peter Eckhorn said that they were to play every night from 7 until 2 in the morning, except Saturdays, when they would play till 3. And mostly they were backing their acquaintance of the previous trip, Tony Sheridan. Photographers started to take notice, and Stu Sutcliffe's romance with Astrid grew. She persuaded him to drop his greasy teddy boy haircut in favour of a more adventurous style, with the hair well-washed, cut differently, and brushed forward. Now, the others were sceptical at first, but eventually, with the exception of Pete Best, they all adopted it, and the famous haircuts were born.
Now, if I go back on the haircut thing, I know it was actually because we saw some guy in Hamburg whose hair we liked. We asked him to cut our hair like he did his. He didn't do it quite the same as his, and it fell down in a Beatles coat. He was a very sort of artsy guy, this guy. He was a great guy called Jürgen. He was a photographer friend of everyone's from Hamburg. And he was living in Paris. He cut our hair. We just came back to England. All the people in England thought we were German because the newspapers said direct from Hamburg, the Beatles. So all the kids thought we were German. They were all surprised.
And they were billed direct from Germany. And the girls used to say to Paul, especially, you speak very good English for a German band, because nobody knew them.
We went back to Liverpool and got quite a few bookings. You know, they all thought we were German. You know, we were builders from Hamburg, and they all said, you speak good English, you know, things like that. So we went back to Germany, and we had a bit more money the second time. So we bought leather pants, and we looked like 4 Gene Vincents, only a bit younger, I think.
So the pattern of life for the next 2 months was set. Sleep during the day, and work for most of the night, building a fan following. If you happen to think it was a glamorous life in Hamburg in those days, listen to the singer the Beatles were backing, Tony Sheridan.
The circumstances we lived in, you know, the attic we lived in, the top 10, it was atrocious. 4 flights up, Echo got some army beds in, you know, tears beds. And a bucket to wash in, and no window and all that, you know. It's really drastic. And there was this old woman that lived next door, and she was paid by Peter Eckhorn to provide us with a fresh bucket of water every day. And Lennon used to really take it out of us, this old girl. My hobby in those days was collecting old souvenirs from the Nazi time, armbands and flags and badges and Iron Cross medals, a whole lot. And we stuck all this stuff, everybody put something on. Lennon had big swastikas all over and an armband. And we're playing away on stage. We didn't really know then that it was against the law for a start, you know, and people were a bit peeved, so that was the end of that. The Germans used to like to see a visual performance. They couldn't believe us. We were complete nutcases. Thought we were all putty, as we'd leap about the stage and into the audience and all sorts of crazy things and chuck beer all over the place, generally misbehave ourselves. And they got used to this bit of show every night, and they came to expect it, you know. Some period during the night, they'd say, Machschau, Machschau, and depending on his mood, Lennon or somebody would either start stomping the stage to pieces, or Machschau, you too, Machschau, you know. Wah.
Of course, looking back, it seems inevitable that the talent would be discovered. The man who was one of the first to spot it, Alfred Schacht.
My name is Alfred Schacht, and at that time I was the German managing director of the Aberbach organization and was the European director of coordination. Now, one day I was in the Top Ten Club, and there were the Beatles, and they were the backing group of Tony Sheridan at that time. And I came mainly into the Top Ten Club because we worked with Tony Sheridan. And then I heard this group, and I think the next day or a few days later, I was together with Bert Kempfert. And I said to Bert Kempfert, listen, I have heard a group in Top Ten Club, which I think is a very good one and an outstanding one, and we should take care of this group somehow. And so we agreed that the next day we should come into my office, next day at 11 o'clock, come into my office. So we discussed the recording contract, and they said yes, and there wasn't very much discussion, really. They were very happy to have a recording contract, and they were very happy to have a publishing contract, and that was it. And so the first song, I think the first song ever published of the George Harrison and John Lennon, was an instrumental, Cry for a Shadow.
Once the music was published, it was more or less inevitable that they should get together with Bert Kempfert and Tony Sheridan to make some records.
Bert Kempfert thought it was a bit of a laugh. He thought he'd have a go at trying to record a few things. And asked us to go down to the studio one morning, 8 o'clock. But Bert Kempfert didn't have any idea what he wanted us to play. So he said, what have you got that would appeal to a German public? And we'd just been doing this thing called My Bonnie that had been requested by a group of seamen or something, you know. All the kids learn at the school, they, you know, it's known over here. So we rocked that up a bit.
My Bonnie lies over the ocean. My Bonnie lies over the sea. Well, my Bonnie lies over the ocean. Yeah, bring back my Bonnie to me. Bring back my Bonnie to me, to me.
lineup on this session was Paul on bass, George and John on guitars, George electric, and myself on guitar and vocals. And Stuart Sutcliffe had already left then, but he was present as a friend, as an observer or something. And Pete Best on drums, of course. Oh, yeah, we can't forget Pete Best on drums. And the result of the session were a few little ditties, the best known of which, I suppose, is My Bonnie, and an old song by somebody called Ain't She Sweet that John sang. And they did a remix on this about 3 years later. It was number one in Australia because I went there on the strength of it, because I was on the other side.
Yes, as Tony Sheridan said earlier, Stu Sutcliffe had left the group. He was always a talented artist, and his love for art and for Astrid made him decide to stay on in Hamburg, where he intended to get married and study at art college. As a result, Paul moved over to the vacated bass guitar, and the group was now reduced to four people.